Hello and welcome to the podcast created for this week's Forage for Knowledge. Earlier this summer, Danny Fanning, a master's student from University College Dublin, spent a two-month placement at AHGB looking at herbal leys. He talks to Ian Wilkinson of Cotswold Seeds about his farming practices and how he manages his herbal leys. This episode was filmed outside, so in parts it can be quite windy.
Hello, I am Danny Fanning and welcome to the AHGB podcast. Herbal leys has become a hot topic after last year's drought, and today I will be talking to Ian Wilkinson of Cotswold Seeds and founder of FarmEd.
Hi Danny, welcome to FarmEd. Hey, this is a great opportunity for me to tell you about some leys because we're stood right in the middle of our demonstration for herbal leys here, and what we've got is four successive years of herbal ley sowings. So we're stood right next to a first year ley, which is fully flowering. It's about 3 feet high, just under a metre high, and it's got in it all the species that we love to see. So we've got the different grasses, the different legumes, and of course the herbs that give the herbal name its name. Fundamentally, there are simple grasses in here. So we have ryegrass, different types. We have timothy, meadow fescue, and coxfoot, and tall fescue. So there's five or six different grasses, and then we have the legumes. So we've got, you can see this yellow flowering, yellow sweet clover. You can see the sandfoin, the beautiful pink flower, red clover, all-site clover, white clover, bird's foot trefoil, and those are the key legumes in this particular mix at the moment. With the herbs, you can see this beautiful blue flower, the thing towering above everything else, which is now, as it happens, the sun shining, it's full of insects. And that's one of the main herbs in this mix. But of course, there are others in here. And if we look closely, we can see burnets, we can see ribgrass, yarrow, and sheep's parsley. And they all grow on this lovely soil that we have, which is a very light, drought-resistant soil, but it's very alkaline, which means we can pretty much grow any of the traditional forages that have been seen right across northwest Europe for hundreds of years.
It's quite a fantastic looking crop, Ian, and I must say, what would the yield be like in this throughout the year?
Yeah, well, that's a really good question. So what I like about these, Danny, is the fact that they give us such a reliable yield. So because we're not just using one species that responds very well to a particular circumstance, because we've got loads of different species, it doesn't really matter whether it's hot or cold or dry or wet, because all of these different things respond. So in a dry year, the deeper rooting species like the chicory and the sandfoin, they just grow really strongly. In a wet year, of course, the grasses do better. But this is the beauty of these diverse swards, is that they just keep growing almost regardless of what the weather does.
And this can all be done with less inputs as well.
Well, yeah, it's interesting that, you know, I've been doing this for 35 years, and what's always struck me is that we spend a lot of money on inputs. You know, I mean, these trucks, this farm here is only a small farm, it's 107 acres. But, you know, the trucks, when they come down the drive onto a farm like this, you know, can have thousands of pounds worth of fertilisers or pesticides, depending on what crop we're looking at. But that, to me, is a lot of money for a farm these days. You know, these commodity prices that we're getting for food that we grow, you know, they're pretty low, and it just seems to me it's important to recognise that we can actually grow a lot of this ourselves, particularly when it comes to forage. I mean, you're from Ireland, so you you know better than anyone, but, you know, we can grow a lot of grass in the climate that we have. You know, we're lucky in northwest Europe. We've got this wonderful climate for growing grasses and the legumes, you know, the clovers, and of course the herbs.
And what would be the main advantages you see in the herbs?
Well, I think, you know, for me, the yield thing, there's a number of factors here, but let's deal with the yield thing first. So the yield, you know, when you combine different plant species together, you get something called an over-yielding effect. And that means that because the different plants are growing, different species are growing at different times of year, in different spaces, you know, some are really low to the ground, some are towering above, some are deeper rooting, some are shallow rooting, some grow early in the spring, some grow late in the summer, and so on. All these overlap. So with a forage crop like this, you can get the benefit of extra yield for nothing, just by using different species, as opposed to getting extra yield by putting on nitrogen fertiliser. Not all species respond well to nitrogen fertiliser, and a lot of these species that we're looking at here today are nitrogen-fixing plants. So what we get is just this lovely, rounded, wholesome, robust-type mixture that just keeps on growing for nothing. I mean, all these leys you can see ahead of us, all these different years, you know, you can see it pretty much onto the horizon, they're all growing purely with sun, soil and rain. That's it. And if it doesn't rain, we had a real drought here last year, like a lot of the middle of England was really, really badly affected by drought. But, you know, these leys kept growing, and it's astonishing, really. I mean, in fact, this one we're looking at now was sown in May, right at the beginning of that dry spell. and look at it. You would not know, would you? It's because we've got all these different species. So the ones that grow really quickly, like the sweet clover, cover the ground and stop the soil drying out. And here's a lay look that we're just behind us now, which is sown this May. So it's only been in the ground for a couple of months. And you can see already it's a very small plant. Now, you can see the diversity in all the little different plants, the different grasses, the different legumes and different herbs. And you can also see here that we're growing a bit of buckwheat. And this buckwheat acts like an umbrella just to protect over the top of the of these newly emerging seedlings. But within another month or two, this will be grazable. And, you know, this will be up to knee high, and we'll put the sheep in here in this case and graze it off to tidy it up. Any weeds that come through, you can see a few weeds in between the drill rows here. They'll be taken out, hopefully, by the sheep. And then we'll be left with our lovely lay, which is the next one, which we've just been talking about at the beginning of our conversation, which, as you can see, is just... This is exactly what this was 12 months ago. And look at it now. You wouldn't believe the contrast, would you?
Mm. You mentioned weeds there, Ian, and I suppose one of the big questions around herbal lays is how do you manage weeds? So you said the sheep can kind of knock them out, or is it?
Yeah, so there's a lot of things going on here. With a monoculture like a ryegrass, you know, it would be the same with a red clover on its own, the same with a lucerne on its own. If you've got one single species, there's going to be a time when it's not competitive, and that's a problem. So inevitably weeds will come. So think of docks and thistles in ryegrass. You know, we all know it happens. But when you're combining, in this case, 15 or 16 different species, look, a year on, there is no space for other species. We've got no docks on this farm. We have docks. Mm. They grow. But when we mob graze them, which we'll explain, I'm sure later on, have a chat about that. But, you know, they go. They get mobbed out, and they just disappear. And this 12 months on, you can see, look, there's the odd, you know, annual weed showing up in this, a little bit of sow thistle. There's a bit of speedwell and a bit of chickweed and things. But that'll be gone. Absolutely gone. Once you get the pressure of this combined effort with all these different plant species, it just swamps everything else out.
So the increased species kind of increases the competition, which reduces the weed pressure.
Exactly. You're just combining all these different things together to produce huge numbers of plants all doing different things, covering the ground effectively. So it's good because it keeps the moisture in, it's good because there's no gaps, and it's good because there's no weeds. And this is typical of farms that are growing these diverse lays. What you don't want, in my view, is not enough diversity, because that doesn't give you the weed control. Then you'll end up looking for herbicides. It's difficult if you've already got two or three different species in your mix to get a selective herbicide that can take these weeds out. You don't need herbicides with these type of mixtures.
How many species would you be looking for in a mix, or does it depend?
It's a good question. I mean, it varies. Obviously, there are some soil types that are restrictive in the number of species that we can use, but there's no point putting an alkaline lover on an acid soil. But, you know, within reason, most soils can grow 10 species. Some soils, like this one, for example, could go 15 to 20 species. But, there's a lot to choose from. And we've forgotten a lot of all this from years ago. You know, the farmers before us were using all these species. You've only got to read the history books to see that was the case.
There's really a lot to learn from past literature on how to manage these herbal lays, isn't there?
Absolutely. There's some classic books out there. The best one I can refer you to is the Clifton Park Farming System, which was written by Robert Elliott a couple of hundred years ago. But he describes exactly how to build soil fertility, which is where we come from on this particular farm. That's the first thing we want to do, because that underpins the whole of our farming. And he was farming in Napoleonic times, actually, and a really low wheat price, lots of cheap imports coming in from France, and he decided that he'd go self-sufficient and he would grow his own fertility in the soil. And he used these complex mixes even in those days to build fertility, feed his beef cattle. He was on the Scottish borders, and he wrote an excellent book, and that's well worth reading, even if you just dip into it to get the salient points. It's a good short account.
So can you take us through mob grazing and how you manage it?
Yeah, so I don't think Robert Elliott would have done this, actually, in the same way that we do. But then he didn't have electric fencing or mobile water. But what we're doing here is we're taking our flock of sheep, and you can do the same with cows, or you can do the same with cattle, and you keep them tightly together. And in this case, we use an electric fence, and we move them on every 24 hours. Now, that might sound extreme, but if you're moving dairy cows, for example, every 24 hours, it's not a big deal, really. You're probably moving them twice a day. Even your dry cows, it's quite easy to move, or your heifers, it's quite easy to move. So for me, that's not a restriction. And it means that you get to check the animals, of course, regularly. So what we do is we put the infrastructure in of if you effectively a couple of parallel lines of electric fencing, and then we separate small areas within the parallel lines to give us the amount we need. And roughly speaking, an acre of grass would give you, or an acre of herbal lay would give you enough for 100 cows for a day, maybe 300 and 400 sheep, something like that for a day, and then we move them on. And the reason we move them on, the reason we mob them, is because the mob will graze it very intensively. All the dung and the urine will go straight behind them, of course, onto that space. They won't have time to be too selective. They'll take the whole lot, they'll trample everything in, and then 24 hours later, they're moving on to the next strip. The benefit of that is that behind them, you've got almost immediate regrowth. Those animals, and particularly animals that are picky like sheep, they'll go back and graze, as you know, and they'll take out the delicate bits that we want to keep. So the reason we're getting all this survival of all these wonderful species is because we're grazing them pretty hard for a very short period of time, but we're allowing them to recover, and for quite a long period afterwards. Mm.
And there's considerable benefit to soil structure and soil fertility.
Yeah, you know, you can see this soil that we're on now is really dry oolitic limestone. This is typical hilltop stony ground. And if you go down about 6 inches, you can see, look, it's really dry. And underneath here is all a 50% stone. So there's no inherent fertility. The only way we're going to be able to farm this soil is if we put something back. And putting something back, in my view, doesn't involve a fertilizer bag. Mm-hmm. We can grow this stuff. These plants, some of these plants make phosphate available, like this buckwheat we're sowing here, as an example. Other plants make nitrogen available, like the legumes, the true clovers that we all know, the red and white clover, but also the lucernes, the sandfoins, and so on. And we can grow without artificials here. Mm. We're proving it. A lot of other farmers doing the same thing. And we can save money, and we can save the carbon impact. You know, the CO2 emissions that are coming from our fertilizers are not insubstantial. We don't need the tractor to apply the fertilizer. We don't need the labor to apply the fertilizer. Effectively, we're using photosynthesis, natural biology, and cheap in this case, or it could be any livestock for that matter.
There's a big advantage to the environment, so, isn't there?
Oh, a massive environment. I mean, you can't underestimate how many things these impact on. I mean, of course, as farmers are the custodians of the land. You know, 3/4 of this part of the world is farmed in one way or another for food, for us to eat, one species. So the farmer has this great responsibility upon their shoulders. For me, these type of farming systems, which involve deep-rooting herbal lays, so if you think of a typical rotation, for example, certainly in this part of the world, you'd have 4 or 5 years of fertility-building lays for sheep grazing, for cattle grazing, for cow grazing, and then you'd have 4 or 5 years of cropping. That's a very sustainable regenerative style system. It's completely different to having continuous wheat and oilseed rape or continuous grassland. So it's a mixed farming system. You have, inevitably in a mixed farming system, lots of smaller outputs, but more of them, more diversity. And that's the key thing, really, is to get more diversity both in your plants that you're growing and in the animals that you're producing.
And how does animal production fare on diverse lays?
Well, it's good news. I mean, from everything we've seen, I mean, both, you know, anecdotally in the field and talking to farmers, and also scientifically, the results are really interesting because we're getting very high quality proteins, we're getting good quality yields, we're getting good all year round production. There's no shortage of forage here on this farm, and even in the dry years, it still grows really well. So effectively, everything that we're growing is healthy for the animals. That some of these plants contain natural health properties. So, for example, the chicory, the sandfoin, and the birdsfoot trefoil are all natural wormers, which means that, you know, from a farmer's perspective, it means we don't have to use wormers on this farm, which is very good. So the sheep are, in this case, are very healthy. So the same would be true of cattle and cows. In terms of protein, well, there's a lot of protein in this, and if the grasses are, you know, running out of steam in the middle of the summer when it goes dry, then the protein is coming from our legumes, which of course are protein rich, and they hang on to their protein really well. And some of the protein that's going through animals, particularly through the ruminant animal, is treated differently when it's produced with a sandfoin or a birdsfoot trefoil, for example. These taniferous plants protect the protein as it goes through the ruminant animal. It goes to their lower gut rather than being degraded in the rumen, and that means you get better animal production, but it also means you have less methane emissions. Mm-hmm. So these, you know, there's lots of hidden benefits within this approach.
Are herbal lays easy to establish?
Yeah, I mean, we have found it so. We think very clearly about what it is we're trying to do with the herbal lays and where they fit in the rotation. So for us, the most important thing is to get the soil fertility built, and to do that, we need to get the herbal lays established correctly. So in this case, we direct sow the herbal lays in May, but you can undersow the herbal lays into a cereal in the spring, no problem at all, cut the cereal rate down, or you can direct sow in the autumn, but not too late, because if you're going into September, October, the weather closes in pretty quickly, the temperature drops quite rapidly, and that can mean that some of the slower species, some of the more delicate species, can be a little bit slow to get off the mark. So if you're going to sow in the autumn, get it in by August. Now, if you're in a dry district, you maybe need to think about sowing in the spring for that reason.
What are farmers' experiences with ensiling herbal lays?
Yeah, so herbal lays are cut for silage. To me, they're grazing lays, really, but they are cut for silage. And if you imagine you get an excess of growth in May, inevitably you will with any crop, but herbal lays are no different, then there's no reason why you can't cut that for silage. In fact, we took silage from this farm in the spring, and we baled it, and it's fine. Not a problem at all to remove the excess. But I would rather let it bulk up, and as we can see from those sheep over there, they're grazing, bearing in mind that we are now the middle of July, they're grazing for the first time that herbal lay. So we've protected some of our herbal lays to allow those sheep to go on and graze it in the midsummer period. Now, we could have grazed that earlier on this spring, but we chose not to. So we had some early growing forage crops on the farm. We had some yellow trefoil, some rye and some vetches, which protected these herbal lays to allow them to get going. And once these get into their stride, there's no stopping them. If you graze them too early, like anything, you'll stifle them. Mm-hmm. So they're pretty resilient things.
Mm-hmm. So for farmers looking to have grass growers meeting spring milk demand, how would you recommend farmers manage that?
So it's a really good question, because of course if you want to turn out, especially on light farms, if you want to turn out early, you're going to need some grass to go out. So again, it's having different arrows in your quiver. You know, you don't want them all to do exactly the same job, so you need to have some early growth. And again, I would do a traditional approach, which would be growing some fast growing early spring crops to protect these forages. I wouldn't have the whole farm down to one thing, no matter what it was, no matter how good it was. You need different things around. I mean, this farm, we've got lots of different things. We've got some sandfoin over there, for example, which is a very good conservation crop. We've got some the rye and the vetch and the Westerwald ryegrass we have here. We have stubble turnips here. So there's lots of things going on that fit those gaps to allow us for the majority of the year to use these deep rooting swards, which are really important to build the soil fertility.
So what are the main challenges of diverse lays?
I think it's a mindset, really. You know, it's interesting, isn't it? When you know, for me, the barriers are that the herbal lays look really quite different to a ryegrass lay. And I was trained in conventional farming, like many of us, and to have uniform cropping. And I think the difference between that and what we see here, for example, at FarmEd, is the fact that we're really looking at this very ununiform crop, and I think it is an issue that, you know, we're just not used to thinking about. Other than that, I don't think there are many disadvantages. Environmentally, there's a lot of benefits here. I mean, if you look across the crop, there's loads of bees flying around, lots of butterflies. There's a lot of carbon being captured in these soils with these deep rooting lays. I mean, it's very good for mammals. You know, there really isn't a disadvantage.
It's really just a mindset thing to understand that, you know, your herbal lays look different to your standard perennial ryegrass swards.
Yeah, it does look very different, doesn't it? And farmers, we all know how we've been trained, and I just think it's important to recognise that things have moved on a little, and you know. We thought, I mean, going back to the 1980s when I was trained, and beyond that, you know, we genuinely thought that intensification, specialisation was the way to go. And for many things, it has been really, really good. But the consequence of having too much of the same thing is clear for all of us to see. And we need to recognise that, and we need to address it. And one way of addressing the forage situation is to increase the diversity in the swards, for all the reasons we know. You know, nitrogen fixation, it's expensive to buy fertiliser. Protein supply, it's really difficult to think that we can keep bringing soy in from around the world, and it's expensive. We can grow all that ourselves in this part of the world. And it just seems to me madness not to do that.
So for farmers looking to include herbal lays, what would be your top three tips?
I think think if I was going to start with an existing farm that's already running, because that's how they are, then we need to fit it in, dovetail it in without completely changing the system. So I would look to my grazing platform, I'd look to my lightest fields, to the next field that would be replaced, and I'd think, well, is this the one that I'm going to try? And in which case I would then think about the fencing and the water so that I can mob graze, or at least keep the grazing pretty tight. I'd want to be observing it, I'd want to be looking a lot at what's going on so that I can really understand what's happening, so that next time I sow, or next time I make a choice of what I put in, I can be better informed. So I'd keep it fairly close to the yard so I can see what's going on, and then I'd watch it for a year. I'd sow it and watch it for a year. And then I'd learn, and then maybe I'd adjust it a little bit. Maybe I'd do it again just to get a bit more experience and knowledge built up. Because these species that we're looking at now, a lot of people haven't seen them for a long time. Mm-hmm. We might have read about them, we've certainly heard of them. Mm-hmm. But, do we know our sandfoin from our lucerne? Yeah. Probably not, in most cases. And there's nothing wrong with that. Mm-hmm. It's just that we have to relearn this pretty quickly. And the best way is hands-on, first-hand experience is what we should be doing. Peer-to-peer learning, like we're doing, we've been doing this morning with a bunch of dairy farmers. It's been really good fun. We've all learned a lot from each other. Yeah. And this is the sort of way we should be going.
So can you grow herbal layers and treat them like a ryegrass layer?
That's a great question. I think, for me, they are different. If we treat these like a ryegrass layer, and in other words, let's say we've got a 21-day grazing interval and we're grazing them down pretty tight. A lot of these big species won't like that. They won't survive and we won't get the benefit of them. So I think the answer is no, we have to manage them differently. What does different look like? Well, I think we have more growth on them. These are plants that don't grow like a grass. A lot of these are growing quite tall. As you can see, some of these are up to a metre high. I'm not suggesting we always turn the cows into a metre high grass, but you can, and a lot of people do, because in the bottom of that, and as you go through the structure of this sward, there's a huge amount of small leaf stuff. You can see in the bottom of this, look, there's loads of clovers, there's loads of fresh grass coming through. So the whole thing, just because we're looking at the top and that's all we can see from here, doesn't mean that as you look in the bottom here that there's all this lovely fresh growth at the bottom. So I would say you've just got to allow it to grow and don't stifle it. If you put it in a straitjacket, it's just not going to do anything. It's like a bonsai tree. If you crop these things really small, the root structures are tiny and it never does anything. You have to let the forage plants, and that includes grasses, legumes and herbs, you have to let them grow. And if you let them grow, they'll grow beautifully. If you cut them back, they're going to be little fellas, and we don't want that. We want big, healthy, robust plants.
That's all we have time here for today. I'd like to thank Ian Wilkinson for talking to us.
Visit ahdb.org.uk for all the latest news, research and information. And follow us on Twitter @theAHDB to stay up to date.